Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Bernard Madoff, Behind Bars. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Bernard Madoff violated the trust and depleted the fortunes of 4,800 people. He is likely to spend the rest of his life in prison. But up till now, has he been protected by a deregulated financial system and a culture of greed? More on that tonight. Also on Which Way LA, lost jobs and foreclosures are driving entire families from homes to apartments to motels. For the chronically homeless, it's even worse, and resources are dwindling. We'll hear more tonight. First, here's the news. Warren Alney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. There's a new tent city in Sacramento, a reminder of the Hoovervilles created during the Great Depression. Tonight, we'll see what lost jobs and foreclosures mean for families in Southern California, where resources to help the homeless are on the decline. That's at 7:30 tonight. First, this rebroadcast of today's To the Point. After pleading guilty to 11 felony counts in federal court today, Bernard Madoff did not go home to his Upper East Side apartment. He went to jail to wait till he's sentenced on June 16th. In the courtroom, he explained how his scheme worked and what he did with the money. Diana Henriquez was in the courtroom for the New York Times. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Why was bail revoked?
Well, it's the default position at this point in a criminal trial, so it was the burden of Mr. Madoff's attorneys to persuade the judge that bail should not have been canceled and that their client should not be jailed. That was different before he pleaded guilty. At that point, despite what has been reported as confessions to the FBI agents who arrested him, at that point the law considered him innocent and the burden was on the government to demonstrate why he should not be granted bail. The government twice tried to have his bail revoked and were unsuccessful. So that changed when he stood in court and answered guilty 11 times, as Judge Denny Chin put the questions to him. So at that point, the burden shift. And his attorney, Arlie Sorkin, made an effort to persuade the judge that Mr. Madoff was not at risk of fleeing the country, that he had stuck it out thus far and was prepared to return for sentencing in June. The government objected and said that he was certainly at risk of flight, and the judge agreed and said that he would be remanded to jail pending his sentencing.
Judge Denny Chin, he has the incentive to flee, he has the means to flee, and he has the presence, thus he presents the risk of flight. I don't want to hold you too long because I know you're very busy filing stories on this, but and we'll talk about the charges in detail as we go forward. What about his statement that he had, in fact, taken this money and just deposited it in a bank account? Did that explain in any great detail what, in fact, he did and how this scheme worked?
Well, he went further than that. It was about a 6 or 7 page description of what he did. That's where it started. He deposited it in a bank account. And then, as he went on to explain, he moved big sums of money around among various banks here and in London to give the illusion that he was moving money around to buy stocks and to trade stocks, when in fact he was doing no such thing. He would tap that bank account to pay people's withdrawals, to pay the promised returns, and sort of to create a charade that an actual investment business was going on when it wasn't.
And then it all came down when everybody started asking for their money.
Yes, as the markets became more unsettled last fall, as you know, many professional investors thought that the money they had with Bernie Madoff was their safe money. That was the conservative, liquid investment that they could tap when everything else became so much more uncertain and markets became so much harder to move around in. They began to tap that money, ask for refunds, ask for withdrawals, and eventually he just couldn't keep it going anymore.
What was it like in the courtroom?
Oh, it was a tremendous mood of raw but suppressed emotion. You know, courtrooms are very stately places, and the marshals were out in full force today to maintain order. The courtroom was packed. It holds about 80 people, and there was not an empty inch on any of those benches. Most of them were Mr. Madoff's victims. Some of them had gotten there as at 8:30 in the morning to sign a sign-up sheet to give them the right to be heard if they wished to comment. The others had just queued up and gotten in line and filled in. It was striking to watch how rapt and attentive they were as Mr. Madoff read this statement. And then at the end, as he was handcuffed and led away, the judge was already off the bench, and you could just feel the agitation, the almost excitement as people watched him cuffed and walked out of the courtroom. It was a remarkable moment, actually. I've been covering things like this for a long, long time, and it's not a day I'll forget.
Victims were there. They were testifying, but briefly.
Briefly. The judge limited their testimony to just 2 points. First of all, do you object to my accepting this man's guilty plea? And a few people did, quite eloquently. One woman stood and said, we need a public trial to fully explore this heinous crime. Others insisted that a trial was the best way to try to determine who else might have been involved. The judge heard them, but disagreed with them and accepted the guilty plea. Then we turn to the matter of whether or not his bail should be removed and he should be remanded to prison. A number of people had signed up to comment on that, but when the judge said that he was revoking bail and that Mr. Madoff would be jailed, there was a smattering of applause, which he quickly gabbled down, of course, ordering them to be silent. And then he called the roll of all those people who had signed up to speak on that topic and said, you know, only speak if you disagree with my decision. And of course, no one disagreed. One person who was asked if he wished to speak said, do you disagree? And he said, I don't disagree. It's about time.
A memorable moment in a New York courtroom. You said you won't forget it. We won't forget your description of it either. Diana Henriquez with the New York Times, a senior financial writer. Many thanks.
You're welcome.
Lucinda Franks is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and an author, former New York Times reporter, now a contributor to thedailybeast.com. And Lucinda Franks, good to have you on our program.
Well, it's good to be here.
What happens now?
I think the government has a game plan. I think the U.S. Attorney's Office is going to go after a number of co-conspirators salted around the world. And they're going to do it slowly in incremental evidence as it comes forth and bring down indictments, a lot of indictments. I have to say that there are some of my sources, two or three, who really believe the government is seeking closure on this case and it's not going to go any further. But I don't think that that's true. What I've mostly heard are people that say, you know, within the community of former prosecutors, investigators, and the defense team, I've heard that the game plan is going to go forth.
We heard $50 billion at the outset, then $65 billion. Now the figure of $170 billion is being floated around. What does that represent, and is that so much money that the government really has to do something to go after it?
Well, I think so. I think that, you know, it's quite clear that he could not have done this on his own. And as I've reported in the Beast in a few stories I've done, there is money that is salted around in international banks, offshore tax havens like Gibraltar, Luxembourg, Switzerland, and he had a huge amount of money, a massive amount of money, moving through the English operation that he ran, money laundering that is being investigated now by a joint U.S.-UK contingent of investigators, and I think they're going to find a slew of people who have moved massive, massive amounts of money, probably much more than that, $170 million.
Billion.
Accountants, principals of, you know, the lawyers, all sorts of people, employees that that have been involved in this.
Let's start as close to him as it's possible to get with his wife and sons. He has maintained that everything they did was part of his legitimate business and that there wasn't any connection. What are the prospects that they're being investigated and might be charged?
Well, I think they're very certainly being investigated or have been investigated, and there's a great body of circumstantial evidence that has been garnered for on Ruth Madoff. She was a bookkeeper. She was the bookkeeper for the Madoff operations. Employees at the Madoff operations have admitted falsifying trades. They would have had to go right under her nose as bookkeeper. She could not have possibly not known what was happening as the bookkeeper for the three accounts, the money-making, the private family account, and the fraudulent investment advisory account. So she has that. She has the fact that my sources have told me that within this money laundering operation that funneled client funds from New York to England right into the pockets of the Madoff family fund, she received $70 million from Madoff in fraudulent funds. The $15 million that she took out of bank accounts a few weeks ago were $10 million of that was from a company called Comad that was just a tool for Madoff, a funneling organization, a feeder fund that used, fraudulently got money and put it into the Madoff account. So there's a lot of circumstantial evidence. What they're really looking for now is some hard evidence.
One point has been made, and that is that the guilty plea does not involve any sort of bargaining. Consequently, he's under no obligation whatsoever to contribute to cooperate with any investigation. Is that right?
Right. That's absolutely right. And my sources have told me that in actuality, he has frustrated the investigators at the U.S. Attorney's Office no end because he's been, as one source said, jerking us around. One day he'll come in and say the money was here or the money is there. The next day he'll change his tune. He'll just be very mercurial and unforthcoming and really intent on trying to protect his family and getting deals for his family.
Lucinda Franks, again, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, former New York Times reporter, now contributing to the DailyBeast.com. Jim Hedges is president of LJH Global Investments. That's a New York-based alternative investment firm advising wealthy families on hedge funds and other non-traditional investments. And Jim Hedges, good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much.
What would you say with regard to the circle of possible involved people here, and how far do you think it's going to extend, and to whom?
Well, it's my feeling that this is a story which is bottomless in terms of the collusion that was required for Madoff to be successful. When one thinks about the magnitude of dollars, $170 billion that flowed through his fingers over the course of some decades, it involved both internal staff, his accountants, his banks, his brokerage companies, regulators, any number of different intermediaries and salespeople, all of whom could have called into question what exactly was going on. So the notion that Madoff acted alone with uninformed junior employees not knowing what they were doing is absolutely not believable, in my opinion.
Do you think that anybody's really expected to believe it? It seems so utterly beyond possibility here with all of these different folks that would have had to be involved, given that he was dealing with $170 billion.
Well, of course, I don't think many people do believe that that's possible, that he acted alone. But nonetheless, I'm struck by the fact that the government has focused initially solely on Madoff, at least from a public perspective, giving a sense of giving, providing the public justice for the injustice and the crimes that have been committed. But I think really behind this, you have to not only look at the immediate family members, but also the inner circle of staffers, accountants, and of course, as I said, the people that were involved in selling Madoff securities, because none of this would be possible were it not for the people that went out and made false representations to investors to buy into this scheme.
So up to this point, then, have what we've done, or has what the government's done, really been to satisfy the public demand that there be a perp walk?
Absolutely. I think perp walk is a perfect term here, because Madoff is the head of, and he is a nefarious, guilty head of a plan, but he is one part of it. And this was a pathological system. Nothing this grand can take place without the involvement and collusion of lots of participants. And so now that the perp walk is over, I hope that your former guest is wrong, and that this will not end with him, but that this will go on to explore all of the different avenues of both internal, external parties and regulatory bodies, candidly, that also did not do their job.
Well, Lucinda Franks didn't say it was over. She said that there are those who say that maybe this is going to be the end of it, but went on to say that others of her sources believe very firmly that there's no way they're going to leave this alone. And, in fact, they are going to go after the kinds of people that you have mentioned, in addition to those very close to Bernie Madoff. Here's Alexandra Penny. She is one of the victims of Madoff, talking today in an interview with CNN.
I call 911. I expect a policeman to respond to my emergency. I put my money in a securities account. I expect the SEC is going to protect me. I think that an overreaching situation or crime here, really, is that we as investors are really not protected.
Alexandra Penny talking to CNN. Peter Henning is a professor at Wayne State Law School. He specializes in issues related to white-collar crime. And Peter Henning, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me, Warren. I appreciate it.
To what extent can we call the SEC not just to account here, but to say that the SEC in some way is responsible for what happened with Bernard Madoff?
Well, sometimes the SEC is called the cop on the beat for Wall Street and patrolling Wall Street. That's a nice metaphor that doesn't really apply. That the SEC is responsible for a number of rules and enforcing those rules, but it doesn't have the authority, unless it has a strong indication of a violation, to simply go out and start investigating investment advisors and things like that. And, of course, investor protection begins with the investor. In listening to that clip, there is a difference between a thief breaking into the house and someone investing their money. They can do some investigation of it. Now, that said, the SEC certainly deserves some of the blame for allowing this to go on as long as it did. It took no steps to try to examine Mr. Madoff's firm, and it had some indications, at least, that there was fraud. But the SEC over the last few years has really almost been a shell of itself, and in some ways almost afraid of its shadow. So the SEC certainly deserves blame, but it's not as if they took a look at a crime taking place and said, oh, we don't want to have anything to do with that. That, in fact, did not happen.
On the other hand, though, there's pretty good evidence that for many years there was at least one broker and investment professional who was hounding the FCC, saying that, in fact, Madoff was engaged in fraud. They did finally open some kind of investigation in 2006 and then cleared him. Should they have done better than that?
Oh, certainly they should have done better. And there's no excuse for what the commission failed to do, that it was not more aggressive in its investigation. And in fact, in part, Madoff had a sterling reputation, very well regarded. And so that certainly helped protect him. And you always get worried that an agency with law enforcement powers, are they going to be afraid to take on someone who's powerful? That certainly happened here. And the SEC is not blameless, but it all doesn't get laid at their doorstep at the same time. Just like everything else in life, this is very, very complex. And will it help going forward? Yes, it may prevent future frauds, but that does nothing for the thousands of investors who lost some their entire life savings.
You said that the SEC, though, might have been afraid of its shadow during this period of time. Do you think that had a enthusiastic, energetic investigator for the SEC suggested we ought to go after Bernard Madoff, he or she would have lost his job?
If you certainly were putting your career at risk. I mean, I was a low-level attorney at the SEC 20 years ago, and if you wanted to take on someone like Bernie Madoff, you had better have pretty solid evidence that what he is doing is illegal, and you better be ready to establish that both inside the commission and then outside of it. Taking him on would have been a very daunting task, and sometimes you need an agency that is willing to endure the criticism and the public attacks. And certainly over the last few years, the message to the SEC was deregulate, go softer, that America's lost its competitive edge and we can't be too tough on the rules. I think we're now starting to learn just what the effect of that was, not only with Madoff, but in other areas, too.
All right. And if you're supposed to be the cop on the beat, it's pretty tough to take on City Hall, I guess is another thing that you're saying. Let me go back to Lucinda Franks, again, our prize-winning journalist, former New York Times reporter, now contributing at thedailybeast.com. To what extent is Bernard Madoff, I guess you can't call him a scapegoat in this situation, but to what extent is he being called to answer in a very public way here for an entire culture of investment and regulation that was going on around him?
Well, that's a very interesting question. You know, I asked my husband, what's the difference between Lehman Brothers and Bernie Madoff, you know, in the sense of leveraging and you know, borrowing and lending this money that doesn't exist, really. But, you know, I mean, Madoff, for probably more than 13 years, seemed to relish this Ponzi scheme. And this this was not only just a Ponzi scheme to keep, you know, the clients satisfied and to keep the money moving. He skimmed many millions of dollars into his own private accounts. He would, according to one of my sources, he would take out money that belonged to somebody else in their name and put it in his own account. He was stealing money. He was scamming people as well as conducting the Ponzi scheme.
And they thought he was investing their money?
Exactly. And he was taking it out in their name.
Let me go back to Jim Hedges at LJH Global Investments. Is further investigation, do you think, absolutely imperative? And if so, who should it be aimed at?
Well, I believe that first and foremost, we should get some insight into the feeder funds. That's the name that's been applied to the firms and individuals who marketed access to Bernie Madoff. And they offered investors not only the ability to invest with Madoff, but they also offered that they would perform ongoing due diligence and risk monitoring. And so they were either presumably asleep at the switch or not doing their job, or complicitous with the fraud that was going on. And seeing as though the majority of capital that flowed into Madoff Securities came through an intermediary like a feeder fund, I believe that understanding the role that those individuals and firms played is paramount.
Elaborate a little bit on due diligence. What exactly does that mean in a situation like this? And what is risk monitoring? What kind of obligations does that imply?
Well, when somebody as an investment advisor takes a client's trusted funds, as the prior guest talked about, they're under an obligation, a fiduciary responsibility to make sure that the investment is sound and that the issues pertaining to governance and oversight are well maintained and that the strategy is followed. Basically, that the promises that the money manager makes are ones that are being followed through on. And so that process of due diligence is the initial investigative process to assess whether or not Madoff was doing what he said he was going to do for investors. And then risk monitoring is the ongoing monitoring or governance part of the fiduciary responsibility, wherein that intermediary is supposed to make sure that the initial promises that were made were in fact true and they're being maintained. In this instance, in the case of Madoff, these funds of funds, these hedge funds, and these feeder funds seemingly did not either do their due diligence up front, or they simply stopped monitoring the investment afterward and just kept funneling money in without raising questions.
You were on our program a couple of months ago and told us that you, in fact, had performed due diligence on Madoff's investments. What did you tell your clients?
We told our clients in December—in 1997 to not invest with Madoff. I spent about 2 hours in Madoff's office meeting with him personally, and I found that the process that I would conduct of investigating whether or not to put money with his firm, from the strategy, from the governance issues, from the accounting, all of the various issues that you discuss when you do due diligence, that I had one red flag after another. So we've always counseled our clients to stay away. It's important to note that thousands of other people also counseled clients to stay away. Most of Madoff's investors either came through a personal relationship with somebody had with him or through an intermediary that basically fronted for him.
If that's the case, then, let me go back to Professor Henning at Wayne State Law School. If that's the case, and if there are many people like Jim Hedges who, in fact, did perform due diligence and said, don't do this, doesn't that suggest liability of a very significant kind for those who failed?
Well, for the hedge funds or investment advisors who have, and as he described, they have a fiduciary obligation. That is about as high an obligation as the law can impose. For those who failed, I would expect not only their clients to sue them, and they should win, but also I think it's necessary here for the SEC to come down hard. This is where the cop on the beat can really have an effect in sending a message not only to those hedge fund advisors, but to all of them, that you have to take your fiduciary obligation seriously. That there have been reports that people simply passed money on to Madoff and trusted him. He told them he had a black box, and I can't get into details, and they put money in. That's obscene for anybody with a fiduciary obligation. You've got to sit down, and you've got to make sure you're doing your job. So that's really where the policing, I think, is going to have to happen going forward.
Okay. Obviously, this will be going on for a long time. Bernard Madoff is in jail. That's the big development today. We'll see what happens in days to come. Thank you all very much for being with us. Peter Henning, professor at Wayne State Law School, Jim Hedges at LJH Global Investments, Lucinda Franks, formerly with the New York Times, now with the Daily Beast, and Diana Henriquez, our earlier guest, senior financial writer for the New York Times. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. In a moment, lost jobs, foreclosures, and homelessness are bad news in Southern California, but there is a future for Martin Luther King Hospital and Medical School. We'll be right back with Which Way L.A. Warren Ollie back with Which Way L.A. In the aftermath of the Watts riots of 1965, the Martin Luther King Jr. Hospital opened in South Central L.A. But over the years, the level of health care deteriorated to the point where official reports called it dangerous. Last August, the hospital finally shut down. Yesterday, a proposal was made to reopen under the joint control of L.A. County and UCLA. Jim Lott is Executive Vice President of the Association of Southern California Hospitals, which includes both private and public institutions. And Jim Lott, it's good to have you back on our program.
Well, hello, Warren. How are you?
Good. Is this some good news? Hospitals have been closing. This one obviously has left an enormous hole, one of the most underserved, medically underserved areas in the country. This sounds like good news.
Actually, it's terrific news. The hospital serves a community that's seen five other hospitals close since 2002. So we've seen a decrease in the number of beds available. That whole area now has about one-third of the beds that are available in other communities in the country, one-half of the beds that are available in California. So we really do need this in the worst way.
It still will be smaller than the earlier hospital. It had 233 beds. This one's going to have, if they get it going, 120.
Right.
What about the medical school also associated with it? Is that what brought UCLA into the action?
I think UCLA, you know, the UC system has had great experience taking over troubled county hospitals and making them work. In Southern California, they took over the county hospital in San Diego and made it work. They took over the county hospital in Orange County and made it work. So they're the right partner for the county to bring to the table to make this happen. And part of that will be the inauguration of a revitalized education program for doctors.
A lot of people said there was, at the earlier hospital, the one now closed, a culture of failure that was a part of the sort of ongoing situation there. What's the situation with this one in terms of union contracts and the past staff of the old hospital? Are they going to have to be hired back?
Well, listen, I don't think that there's a direct connection between the defective culture that they once had and unionization. I don't believe that exists. I think there were other forces at play that made that county hospital not work where other county hospitals with unions did work. I've got to believe that when we closed that hospital, we scrubbed of all the bad DNA, and that when it reopens, we'll have a county hospital or county-like hospital that is like all the other county hospitals that run well.
But it does specifically indicate, this plan specifies, as I understand it, that the existing civil service rules will not apply to the new hospitals.
Well, there are some things about some of the civil service rules that need to be revamped for any hospital, quite frankly, to be able to operate efficiently. And so I'm really glad to see that the county is considering that, but how much they will be able to do considering the contract with the unions remains to be seen.
What about finding a private operator? I gather neither the county nor UCLA is going to provide that function, and so somebody else is going to have to do it. What efforts are being made in that direction?
Well, you know, for a long time, at least since they began to look for, well, it's been about 2 years, 2.5 years they've been looking for a private operator. There have been two stumbling blocks. One has been a guarantee that there will not be any losses or risks that the private operator would have to take. And the other one has had to do with governance, exactly how the hospital would be governed or overseen by the county board of supervisors. The first issue on financial risk, I think, is the most important one. I think you'll be able to find an operator who's willing to come in and run the hospital if the risk is minimalized.
What about the other part, governance issues? Those have to be negotiated?
Those have to be negotiated, and I think the county's in a mood now where they may not have been before to do that.
So they may be able to make some compromises that just weren't available or on the table before.
That's what we're thinking, that's what we're seeing, and that's what the county is hinting at.
Hard to exaggerate the amount of pressure in that neighborhood to get this hospital open again.
It is the most severely economically depressed community we have in Los Angeles, and the supervisors are under a tremendous amount of pressure to reopen that hospital and provide the services and access to health care that that community needs.
All right. Well, Jim Lott, as always, many thanks for being with us, Executive Vice President of the Hospital Association of Southern California. Always good to talk with you.
Thank you, Warren. Take care.
I'll be right back with Which Way L.A.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Warren Allen back with Which Way LA. Last year, the official count of homeless people in Los Angeles County was more than 70,000. This year's count has not been reported yet, but the call for homeless services is on the rise at the same time that available resources are on the decline. In Orange County, homelessness has been less visible, but it's rising there, too. Paul Leon is founder and executive director of the Illumination Foundation. That's a nonprofit that works to break the cycle of homelessness. They're also working with families who are trying to stay out of the homeless system, living in motels. Paul Leon, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Tell us about these folks, and how close to homelessness are they?
Well, most of the families that we actually bring into the motels were actually in the streets and the shelters, living in cars. We're very close to the beach, so a lot of them were camping out on the beach. That's one half of our motel population. The other half are people that, due to the economy, have fallen through the cracks and were in apartments but could not stay in the apartments and now have come to us for some supplemental rent.
Are they in apartments just because they run out of money, or are, in some cases, the apartments actually being foreclosed on?
Actually, that's happened to quite a few of our clients. They've actually been in apartments, and they were sold, and the rent actually went up. A couple of them have closed, but the majority of them you can see them just fall through the cracks. They were in a home. They went to an apartment. They could not afford an apartment for longer than 6 or 7 months without an income. And then they come to us, and we try to assist them in putting them into a motel.
Now, why are the motels available in Orange County?
Well, we, you know, historically, Anaheim, Disneyland had had a lot of motels that were available. And since the economy has changed, and also there's so many motels that were, low-income motels that they were finding in the city anyway, we went and tried to find family-friendly motels that we could go in, we can book a certain amount of rooms, and then we can assist the families in moving in there. So there has been quite a few motels available in Orange County compared to other areas in California.
I've seen some reports of what it's like for those families to live there. The motels may be family-friendly in the sense that they're willing to let the families stay, but life for the families themselves is pretty different.
Correct. It is not the most optimal location to be placing families in. It is a step up from the streets and the armories and the outdoor shelters that are available. But again, we try to keep the families there temporarily and try to get them into an apartment. So we're looking at about 6 month period that we're keeping them in the motels. And it is difficult. We put them in a one-room studio, and some of our families have 3 to 4 children. So it is definitely a stress on the families.
Difficult for the kids under those circumstances. Do they still go to school?
Oh, yes, yes. As a matter of fact, what we do, we bring in wraparound services to the families. We bring in social workers. We bring in mental health specialists. We bring in tutors. We bring in pretty much, I know in L.A. they have PATH. It is similar to that model. We bring in all the wraparound services right into the motels. We have our offices within the motels. So we're able to work with the families on a daily basis.
That's very interesting. When the kids are living under those circumstances, do they have pets? Do they get to bring friends home from school? Can they do those kinds of things that we think of children doing when they're at home in their houses?
Well, they cannot have pets, but what we do is every 2 weeks we have a birthday party for the children that are there. And again, the motels that we're using are family friendly, and they have a swimming pool, they have a jacuzzi, they have a playground. So we try to make it as close to home as we can. And every other Saturday, some of the groups bring in some animals so they can play with. But make no mistake, it's not like living in your own home. One of the really exciting things that we have going on now is we actually, for the first time in many of these children's whole entire life, they are going to be at one school for the entire year. We enrolled 35 children under the age of 12 into school, and they will complete their first year in June.
Are there teenagers staying in those one rooms, 3 or 4 at a time?
Well, not 3 or 4, but we do have teenagers. Unfortunately, Orange County, with our transitional shelters, not many allow teenagers to go in the transitional shelter, especially boys. So we're one of the only shelters that will take in teenage boys and teenage girls. We have several kids that are age 15 to 18. And as you alluded to before, there's such a stereotype and stigma for them being in high school that it's really difficult for them to tell people that they're homeless. So they don't bring kids back to the motel.
What about the numbers? How different is what you're describing from what was going on, let us say, a year, year and a half ago?
Well, our count, and I know I heard you mention that L.A., I think, was 70,000. Our count in Orange County was 35,000 homeless. So
wow.
We're not far behind L.A. Population-wise, at one time we were second in the nation behind Detroit. So we always have had a chronic problem with homeless. And again, Orange County has never addressed that problem entirely because of the fact that we have such a rich population on one end that a lot of people aren't cognizant that there is that homeless population. But recently, with the economy changing, we have people that will call us, and they have had jobs. They've had $60,000, $70,000 a year jobs, and they were in apartments. They had no safety net, but they were the working poor. And so now what happened, you know, they lost their jobs and they had no safety net. We are their safety net. And we're finding that with the new homeless that we've labeled them, that if we can turn them around really quick and rapid rehouse them into an apartment, they do much better than if they were in the motels for any longer than 2 or 3 months.
Paul Leon, again, founder and executive director of the Illumination Foundation in Orange County. Orlando Ward is director of public affairs at the Midnight Mission. That's a homeless organization on Skid Row in Los Angeles. And Orlando Ward, good to have you on our program.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Are you saying the same trend in Los Angeles County? Are there significantly more people? Are you finding people who've been making jobs, $60,000, $70,000 a year at a time, who are now seeking help in motels?
I am. You know, since August of 2008, we have experienced an extreme spike and the demand for services here at our agency on Skid Row. And leading the charge in that demand has been families. And what has been striking to us is they don't fit into the traditional mold of the families we see here on Skid Row, where they have very apparent underlying issues that cause their condition of homelessness. We are seeing people that are directly impacted from the economic crisis, the foreclosure crisis that we're having in this area, people that have been working, people that are still working, yet where they were living was foreclosed on and they didn't have any safety net or any savings. And so they're thrust into this area of homelessness without, you know, any idea and kind of dealing with the shock of that trauma.
And when you say underlying conditions, you're talking about drug addiction, mental illness, physical disability, that sort of thing.
Yeah, some of the more traditional conditions that are real obvious reasons for people to experience a condition of homelessness.
If they can pay the rent for the motel, why can't they go to regular housing?
Well, you know, when I'm interviewing folks, that's one of the questions that I ask, and most often it is they can't afford. First of all, in Los Angeles, the price of apartment living is way very, very expensive. And secondly, they can't afford the first and last. Some of them, because of their economic situation, have been evicted. That creates another obstacle to obtaining rental property. So, you know, they're forced to live virtually paycheck to paycheck until their funds run out.
Do you have people on Skid Row who came from other neighborhoods and whole families of them that are now living there in that neighborhood?
Absolutely. You know, I think, you know, the speaker earlier talked about safety nets, and what we're experiencing now is an already thin safety net for folks being stressed beyond capacity. So, you know, traditionally Skid Row has been the last house on the block. There are a lot of resources that people go through before they end up on Skid Row. And normally from the time of trauma to when they end up on Skid Row is about 18 months in analysis we've looked at. Recently that's been truncated to 6 months. There just isn't that much help out there. So they're thrust into a world that is completely beyond, you know, the value system that they're accustomed to.
And this is with children as well, so they're seeing things that they might not have been exposed to under normal circumstances.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What about California law when it comes to staying in a motel? How long can you stay before you begin to acquire rights as a resident that then the landlord has to worry about if they want to get you out?
Yeah, you know, those are always problems that we were looking at. Here in Los Angeles, we had been experiencing something that is termed as a 28-day shuffle. And some of the commercial hotel enterprises where lower-income people were staying would have the tenant move at the 28-day mark so that they could not establish residency, which entitles them to a certain level of security and rent assistance should they should the use of that facility change. Now, the protections under the law are murky at best. We happen to have in the city of Los Angeles, particularly in the downtown area, some pretty active social justice organizations that have been fighting for the rights of tenants in these motels. And our city council has recognized that that is a problem and have put in place ordinances to protect people against that so-called 28-day shuffle.
Orlando Ward, again, Director of Public Affairs at the Midnight Mission in Skid Row, or on or near Skid Row, in downtown Los Angeles. Paul Leon said a moment ago that Orange County hasn't addressed the issue of homelessness to the extent that some other places. In Los Angeles County, there is the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, LASA. That's a joint powers agency of the city and county of Los Angeles, created in 1993. The executive director is Rebecca Isaacs, and good to have you on our program.
Nice to be with you.
Are you saying overall, we certainly heard this from Orlando Ward, who's in Los Angeles County, but are you saying that at the time that services are being demanded in greater amount than they have been in the past, resources are not keeping up?
Well, there have never been enough resources for the numbers of homeless that we have in Los Angeles. It's basically, we have many, many, many more homeless people on the streets, and in each level of service that we possibly can fund, each one of those is completely overloaded. And one of the things that's happened this year is, for example, we run a winter shelter program December 1st through March 15th, just ending this weekend. And in those 13 sites, we've seen many, many more families than we ever did before. And families don't stay in the in these winter shelters. They're vouchered into motels. And basically, we ran through our allotment of vouchers very early and had to, you know, sort of keep scrounging up new dollars to keep the families, housed in those motels.
What happens when they can't be housed in the motels?
Well, I mean, we do a lot of shuffling around. We have a homeless CalWORKs Families program. We have 20 people actually on staff here who work with the Department of Social Services. Right now we have a caseload of about 300 families who basically we have in some in motels, some in emergency shelters that are up to 90 days. Hopefully some of the other ones are going to be moving into transitional housing and permanent housing. Many of them are waiting for Section 8 vouchers. One of the other things we've tried to be very inventive and looking, you know, for private individuals who have space, who are willing to, you know, accept families for the rate that we can pay in some of the other shelters. So we've just been as inventive as we possibly can with the resources we have to make sure that families don't end up on the street. And I think any of the institutions, and I know Orlando's organization very well, you know, people will not let the families be on the street if we know anything about them. But it doesn't mean that the accommodations are at all acceptable. They're just literally off the street.
When the formal winter period ends this weekend, are you going to be able to continue to use those shelters to house people, or because winter is over, do they have to leave?
That program closes March 15th, and it's a hardship for people. That provides 1,700 beds during the winter for individuals and, you know, basically also vouchers for families. And it's a real hardship, I think, when that closes because we just don't have enough beds. Now, basically, anybody would pretty much tell you that the winter shelters are also shelters of last resort. They are housed in armories. Basically, you know, they're set up and taken down every evening. They're very kind of basic, although we do really try to hook them into people who come to the winter shelters into the larger continuum of care, which, you know, gets them hopefully, you know, some case management, some, you know, hooked up with employment services potentially, or definitely with food and other options. But it's a very, very tough situation.
If you have to break them down every day, what happens to kids that have to go to school and then find their way back after school's over?
Now, remember that the families with kids are going to be in the motel.
They're going to be in the motel.
The situation is in Orange County, right? And it is tough because it's not very stable for kids. And, you know, a lot of organizations have spent time with local schools making sure that kids are accepted in those schools. That doesn't mean that it's very easy for the kids at all. But I do know that there are schools where they're very receptive and they really work hard to make the kids feel comfortable. But I don't think that's certainly not the case at every school.
Rebecca Isaacs, again, Executive Director at LASA, the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, a joint powers agency of the city and county of Los Angeles. Orlando Ward at the Midnight Mission. What about private contributions? What's happening there?
Well, it's been tough actually for the last 2 years for agencies like ours that rely primarily on private contributions. And since the announcement, if you will, of the recession late last year, we have actually seen our private donations plummet to the tune of 23%. You know, at the same time, you know, as all speakers have been talking about today, the demand for services of the type that we offer is skyrocketing.
Paul Leon, with the Illumination Foundation in Orange County, do you expect to get stimulus money or federal money in order to help meet this growing need?
Well, we're hoping for it. As Mr. Ward alluded to, we also get private donations, and it's been declining the last few months. And we understand that there are some preventative measures from the stimulus package. I think for Orange County, it's $1.3 million. And traditionally, Orange County had to fight for everything we've gotten down here because of the fact that a lot of people just assume that Orange County has money and can take care of their own homeless population. But we are hoping to get a portion of the stimulus package when it comes down in the next few weeks. And again, we suffer, like Ms. Isaac said, that we also have two cold weather shelters, and this is the first year where we've actually been able to take the children out of the shelters. Last year, our cold weather shelters had children in them. We had up to 150 children in each of our shelters. So the numbers were staggering, and they continue to grow. So we are hoping that something comes down the pipe and we're able to do a little preventative housing rather than wait to the last minute and just have to house them at motels.
Orange County with 35,000 homeless, $1.5 million in stimulus money, maybe. Rebecca Isaacs, back to you with LASA. Do you expect to get homeless money in Los Angeles County?
Yes, we know what the allocation is going to be. It's going to be for L.A. County just about $12 million, and for City of Los Angeles, just about $29 million. And
that sounds like a lot.
Well, you know, what's really, really important about it is that, and that's just the funding for homelessness. There are several other poverty-related pots of funding. And what's going to be very, very important about this money when the regulations actually come out for how these are going to be spent, the idea for these is this is really for the first time about homelessness prevention, which I think we haven't spent enough time on, is how to keep people out of the homeless system, how to get them rapidly rehoused. Somebody mentioned rapid rehousing. The idea is basically what is it that people need? Orlando mentioned what people have problems with in getting housing first and last month, you know, those kinds of rental subsidies, things that will keep them from, you know, getting into that kind of situation where they're completely unstable.
So, all right. We will come back at the time the stimulus money begins to show up and talk more about this and what's being done for the prevention of homelessness. In the meantime, thank you all very much for being with us, and thank you for the work that you do. Rebecca Isaacs at LASA, Joint Powers Agency of the City and County of Los Angeles, Orlando Ward at the Midnight Mission, and Paul Leon at the Illumination Foundation in Orange County. Producers of Which Way LA are Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Andrea Brody, Katie Cooper, Sonia Geis, and Gary Scott. Our managing editors, Cameron Radziner, Technical Director Mike Newport. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for Which Way LA, 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.